This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio, my friends and all listeners from around the world. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. Thank you for taking the time to tune into the program today and for your interest in listening and learning about the other side of the story. We offer you different opinions and research material on many different kinds of subjects, all that we think you'd benefit from listening to and learning more about. If you're new to the program, check out RedIceCreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E Creations.com. A bunch of good stuff for you there to dig into. Today we have Dr. Erik Karlström with us from Colorado. He is a professor of geography and came to California State University, Stanislaus, in 1990. After 5 years as an assistant professor at Northern Arizona University. He was a visiting professor at the University of Kansas for a year and an adjunct professor at the University of Wyoming for another year. Throughout his career, Dr. Karlström has continued his research program in field and laboratory analysis of soils and geomorphology as means of reconstructing quaternary paleoclimates. This research has involved field investigations in Montana, Northern Arizona, Kansas, Wyoming, Alberta, and British Columbia. He is with us today to discuss climate change propaganda, social engineering, and the dark side of the green movement. Well, as I said to you before, I wish we had some global warming up here in Sweden because it's been a cold June so far. Kind of a standard procedure here in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so. Some days in May can be quite warm and nice, but then it kind of drops again for some reason. I don't know, maybe we can get closer to some of that, the reasons for that here today. But tell our listeners a little bit about your background, Erik, what you're a professor in, what you've worked with, and also how you came to your little discovery and awakening here when it comes to the natural climate change.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I got a PhD in physical geography from the University of Calgary in 1981, and then up until this last fall, I've been a professor of physical geography. My research in Glacier Park was on the glacial history and looking at the timing of past major natural climate changes, glacials and interglacials, by looking at the soils and the landforms and the stratigraphy or the sequence of stacked glacial deposits called tills. And my breakthrough in terms of my own research, which was published in 81, and then in subsequent papers in the journals, including a number of international journals, was that past interglacials, based on the characteristics of the soils, the paleosols, we'd call them old soils, were considerably warmer and somewhat wetter than the present interglacial, which is the last 10,000 years, which we call the Holocene. Now, the Holocene is the period when humans have evolved through their agriculture and their cultures to their present state. And a lot of scientists and others think that this could not have happened during the late Pleistocene, or what we call the Wisconsin glaciation, or the Brits call the Weichselian, or the Germans call the Würm. But during the last full glacial, about 120,000 years ago to 20,000 years ago, it's a full cycle. The climate was much colder. Sweden would have been covered with ice, as would have Canada for the most part.
Yeah.
And but then things warmed up a lot, and they warmed up about 15,000 years ago. The glaciers melted back, and we've experienced wonderful global warming in the last 15,000 years, which has provided the ideal temperatures and stability for humans to spread out over the earth, as well, and other plants and animals have also thrived. So anyone who studies the earth history knows that, will learn, it's there in all the books, that most of the earth's history has been considerably warmer than even the present, and that we have, temporarily, we have these breakdowns in our climate system, which we call glaciations, and it gets much colder. And at that point, there's a lot of stress on plants and animals. They all are forced to migrate towards the equator. and many go extinct, and shorter lifespans, etc. So the whole idea of being afraid of global warming is actually pretty silly, because even if we look at the last 1,000 years, we see that during the medieval warm period, when the Vikings were, you know, conquering Europe,
right?
The good old days, you know, for the Scandinavians, the climate was very favorable, and the growing seasons were longer, and people were wealthier, and they lived longer, and it was good times. And then around 1300 AD, we had natural global cooling, and of course the Viking colonies over in Greenland, the people got shorter and shorter, and eventually the community died off because it was so cold. And so we know from looking at the historical records of the Little Ice Age, between about 1300 and 1860 AD, that global cooling is what is actually to be feared. Growing seasons are shorter, lifespans are shorter, and hard times for plants and animals and humans.
That's right.
Yeah.
Eric, what led to this sudden warming here about 15,000 years ago then? I mean, since, as far as we know, there wasn't any SUVs developed yet, right? So.
Absolutely. Yeah, just imagine 18,000 years ago during the last full glacial, sea levels around the world, 300 or 400 feet, or say 100, 150 meters lower than today, would have, you know, the continents would have been a little fatter because there's a lot of continental shelves exposed. The climate would have been more continental all over the world. And so what caused the warming, the radical warming? Well, in fact, if we look back at the record, the paleoclimatic record, we see that there have been about 20 such full glacial interglacial cycles during the last 2 million years that we call the Quaternary period of Earth history. And in about the 40s, a Serbian genius by the name of Milutin Milankovic did all by hand, enormous numbers of mathematical calculations involving the astronomical relationships between the Earth and the Sun and the Moon, and found variations in the Earth's orbit around the Sun. And he was able to work on the progress of other scientists like Kroll and Adamar and others, and put together a theory of climate change that that these cycles of the Earth's variation, the variations in the Earth's orbit around the Sun, with three different variations with 100,000-year, 40,000-year, and 20,000-year periodicities, that these would explain the timing of the glacial interglacial cycles. And this was not accepted for a long time, just like the theory of continental drift by Alfred Wegener was not accepted for a long time, until more data came in. And by about 1977, 1980, the deep sea core records were proving that the timing that Milankovic predicted had in fact occurred in the past. And so it would appear that these variations in the Earth's orbit around the Sun are somewhat of the main pacemakers, drivers of these major glacial interglacial cycles. But saying that, we also have a trend towards cooling throughout the entire Quaternary period. That is, we were warmer in the Tertiary about 3 million years ago, between 3 and 65 million years ago, considerably warmer. Animals were much bigger. You had the Oligocene gigantism of various creatures, etc. And then it's been sliding. We're still in a glacial period. We're still in an ice age, but we're in a warm interval, or an interglacial period, or interglacial stage within that glacial period. So I think you can see the trend in the last 2 million years is towards cooling. So each glaciation and each interglacial appears to be a little bit cooler than the previous. So again, if we want to be afraid of something, let's at least be smart enough to fear global cooling, because more people die, you know, from problems related to cold than warm.
That's right. So if we look at the Milankovic cycle that you talked about, how does the long term versus the short term look here? What are we in for if this is indeed the correct cycle?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, a very good question. Again, looking at the Little Ice Age, which occurred between about 1300 AD and 1860 AD, we saw glaciers expand in the mountain areas of the world. And this was one of the coldest periods of the last 10,000 years that we call the Holocene epoch. Okay, so I think what we're looking at is, you know, right now we have a period from 1850 to the present, which we call the modern warming, probably all a natural cycle. But I think that we will probably be sliding back into cooling phases rather shortly. I don't think we'll have a 2 mile thick ice cap on Canada like we did 18,000 years ago very soon. You know, it might take another, oh gosh, maybe 10,000 years for, mm-hmm. or more for that to form. But to move into what we have in climate, it's very complicated, which is why the propagandists are able to snow people, so to speak. A little joke there.
Right.
They're able to snow us because it is so complicated. But what we seem to have is cycles on cycles, short-term cycles, long-term cycles, trends. And then we have a lot of noise, which is changes that are going on that don't seem to relate to any trend at all. So, you know, the statisticians, climatology is fraught with many different subspecialties. And can be kind of captured by this or that subspecialty, and the whole field has been captured by the computer science subspecialty, which many of the so-called experts may not know anything about climatology.
Yeah.
They're computer scientists, and but they do know how to plug in a bunch of assumptions and get on some very, very sophisticated computers, like the Cray computers, that can do millions of calculations per second. And then they can run their scenarios. And this is the basis of all the predictions from the United Nations sponsored Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change sponsored research.
Absolutely. So what could potentially stop this looming ice age? I can't help to think sometimes that mankind indeed has discovered the so-called fossil fuels at this time for a reason. Can we go that far, Eric?
Well, I don't think so, because, okay, there's some very interesting books that have come out in the last couple of years that I think are worth looking at. One of them is by a paleoclimatologist down in Australia, down under, called The Climate, The Counter Consensus. Now, Carter, Professor Robert M. Carter, is a guy who has studied deep sea cores, and he's done an excellent kind of rebuttal to all the stuff coming out of the BBC and the United Nations, all this propaganda that we're hearing, the ice is melting, the polar bears are dying, sea levels rising, all this nonsense, all these elements of propaganda. And then there's another excellent book by Canadian climatologist, actually, who was the first PhD student out of the University of London, I believe, that's where it was. Might have been University of East Anglia. Anyway, his name is Dr. Tim Ball out of Canada, and he's got a book called Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. Well, turns out there's a whole lot of information which has been suppressed. What we see as we start to look more deeply is that certain disciplines get co-opted by the world power structure, and then the real science seems to go underground and seems to be tightly guarded by the world power structure, the global elite. And then what gets publicized and disseminated is what I guess one of my students called junk science. And it would seem that this book does a pretty good job of showing that the idea that a little tiny trace gas, carbon dioxide, which is 380 parts per million, or less than 4 molecules per 10,000, the idea that a tiny little trace gas like carbon dioxide would actually have any noticeable effect on the temperature locally or globally is absolutely ridiculous and defies the first and second laws of thermodynamics, among other things. But this idea has gotten so disseminated that it becomes kind of a verity, kind of a truth in the minds of the public. But the public mind does not understand the science behind it. What they understand is the repetition of good propaganda, yeah. Which, by the way, makes its way into the textbooks. Having been a professor at a university, I know, you know, there's a lot of money. There's a big gravy train out there for people who are willing to prove or try to prove that humans are causing global climate change. And there's a reason for this. There's the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, actually was given terms of reference for research by the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which preceded the IPCC. And the terms of reference for the research, which nations have now coughed up over $100 billion to perform, the terms of reference were written by a guy named Maurice Strong from Canada. Maurice Strong has a ninth grade education. Think about that.
Yeah.
A guy with a ninth grade education has written a paragraph saying that we're going to define climate change as human contributions to climate change. We are going to ignore natural climate change. And we are going to fund now all efforts to discover how humans are causing climate change. Well, then the biologists jump on board and talk about the, you know, what the squirrels are doing, and everybody jumps on board this gravy train, except the guys like me who have been studying natural climate change, who are more or less shut out. So
guys like me just
do what we can, you know.
Absolutely, Eric. How did this happen? I mean, you were on board. Everything is nice and dandy with the science. You're teaching at this point, and then all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, this goes this is against the research. Or how did you come about this?
Well, yeah, I got my PhD in 81 at the University of Calgary on the glacial history of Glacier Park, and I would say even by that time, now I've gone back and looked at the documents. This is a connection with Sweden. In 1972, the same guy, Maurice Strong, organized the first global environmental conference in Stockholm, as you're probably aware.
Yep.
And even then, he was trying to convince governments. Again, the guy with the ninth grade education was trying to convince governments that global warming was a global problem. Now, why would they want to convince everybody that global warming is a global problem? Well, as Gordon Brown, the former prime minister of Britain, said, global problems require global solutions, which means we got to now have carbon taxes and give that money to the United Nations, and they're going to control world economic activity, and it's a move towards world government. And obviously, since this all started probably even before 1972, and I have documents from the Club of Rome, I think a little bit before that, this is coming from think tanks that find a kind of a political advantage to this issue. Again, global problems require global solutions. We have, now all of a sudden the United States or Sweden or any country has to give up some of its sovereignty to these global institutions. We have to give up our right to control our own energy policy, for instance.
Yeah.
And this is what the Obama climate bill has tried to do, but it has not been successful because the Republicans, for a change, the good guys, have not passed it. So.
Okay. So this is some of the ideas of Maurice Strong, very important. Is he one of the progenitors of this, would you say? And is this idea come out from the Club of Rome as well? Are there more people involved here, Eric?
I certainly believe so. In fact, I've been teaching a course called Human Ecology since 1990 when I started teaching at California State University, Stanislaus. And I was assigned then to teach a course called Human Ecology. And this is a relatively new field. I hadn't even heard of it until I got to California. But I've always been an environmentalist, I thought, and I believed in, being good to the earth because I love hiking and climbing and I love nature, etc. So I'm trying to figure out exactly where this is going. Your question again was?
Well, if there's more people involved, I guess, then Maurice Strong, or if he's
exactly
like the only one behind this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Very good question. So anyway, the reason I led into that introduction to answer that question was that for the first 10 years, between 1990 and 2000, I basically was going with textbooks mostly from the field of biology called environment or environmental science, and a lot of good information in there. But I remember at the end of about 2000, one of my students got up at the end of the course and he kind of stalked out of the room saying, junk science, you know. Well, obviously there was a backlash politically. My initial response was, well, that's crazy. How would I be teaching junk science, you know? But anyway, I started looking at it from the other side of the coin, which is the political right, and realized that this guy is right. And a lot of the, you know, doomsday scenarios that we were feeding these poor kids, just these depressing information, you know, the sky is falling, there's too many people, you know, all this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
That is almost, you know, it is propaganda. But anyway, then I started reading the other side. And it turns out that, yeah, the Club of Rome was interested in this stuff. This stuff was coming out in kind of official documents in the United States, such as the report from Iron Mountain, which goes back, I think, to 1966, saying that, listen, we got to have a war economy because we can't share the wealth with the poor because then our class system will break down. So we have to always have an enemy to target against. But what about if we found a substitute for war that would be a little bit more benevolent? We still have to find an issue that would fulfill the same function. In other words, we could destroy 10 or 15% of the wealth of the country to make sure that our class lines are frozen in place so that the poor don't get educated. Well, then they started saying, well, maybe the best bet is going to be in the environmental issue with global warming, et cetera, as the enemy, the common enemy.
Huh.
So these documents, like the report from Iron Mountain and reports in CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, by a guy named George Kennan, who actually set up the Cold War strategy under Eisenhower, et cetera, or helped set it up, this was coming from real top-notch high think tanks. So I think we can trace it back to the mid-60s.
Wow, interesting. So why did they pick carbon? Couldn't they have picked like anything, really? And if so, why carbon?
Well, that's also an important question. Well, of course, carbon dioxide is an industrial gas in the sense that 85% of our energy comes from the burning of fossil fuels, which are, you know, coal, oil, and gas, and all of them are carbon-based. So when we use and burn these fuels, carbon dioxide is released. So I think the powers that be thought that it might be easier to regulate economic activity by regulating the byproducts of economic activity, CO2, than the actual products. I think that's been the strategy. At least that's been the United Nations strategy all along.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So carbon dioxide is absolutely, you know, absolutely related to the burning of fossil fuels. And as I say, the world gets 85% of its energy for all economic activity from the burning of fossil fuels. And there is a direct correlation between the amount of energy use and wealth. So if we cut back our use of fossil fuels, say by 80%, which is what the Kyoto 2, Phase 2 calls for by, say, 2050, then that means our wealth goes down commensurately by 80% unless we find a substitute. Now, can wind and solar move in and take up that slack? No, they'll only get, they're the perpetual kind of marginal solutions, partial solutions. Maybe 10 or 20% of the total energy will come from wind and sun because, of course, they're intermittent. So, again, there's been a lot of, there's an enormous push from the top to get this nation, our country, and as well as the industrialized countries of the world, such as Sweden, off of fossil fuels in order to make them poor, to share that wealth with the third world, to kind of level everything and increase poverty, which I see as an attack on industrial Western civilization.
That's interesting. 1972, obviously, the Club of Rome put out that report, The Limits to Growth.
Right.
I think that this is to stifle human development, progress, basically, to a certain degree.
Yeah, and I think that is an important document, the 1972 Limits to Growth. And let me just say that I was going to graduate school in the 70s, and, you know, my friends, some of my friends, you know, and I were very much on board. You know, we really kind of were have been programmed into this, I would call us, you know, the students who go to the better colleges and everything and get the good quality education. Well, we all have this notion that, you know, that there are too many people. And friends of mine, you know, decided, well, I'm not going to have any kids because there's too many people. Well, turns out that this ideology of scarcity and overpopulation traces back again to the ruling elite, to guys like Thomas Malthus, you know, in the late 1800s, the British Anglican priest. And the ruling elite have always bought into this idea and wanted to persuade others that there's too many people because basically they do not want to share the wealth. And so I think that we can see that the real motivation for the global warming propaganda is twofold. One, to reduce economic activity in the industrial world, and two, to reduce the population. Because, of course, our agricultural system is also based on fossil fuels. And if we were to reduce our use of fossil fuels by, you know, any significant amount, that would have a direct effect on our food supply, mm-hmm. Internationally and nationally.
Now, what do you think about viable options here? Because it's almost like, to me anyway, that we're given these two options. It's like either it's fossil fuels or it's almost at this point then nothing at all. Or as you said, wind and solar, and that seems to be kind of not enough, if you will. There are some interesting ideas out there. People are talking about free energy. I've brought this up many times, but I'd like to get your take on that. Is there any viable options that just hasn't been put on the table yet, do you think?
I do think that that's the case. You mentioned free energy. Nikola Tesla, of course, was the genius inventor from Serbia who came to this country, the United States, back, I guess, in the early part of the 20th century. And he was kind of a competitor and sometimes collaborator with Thomas Edison. He wound up inventing the radio and alternating current electricity, and he has something like 700 patents. And he was the god of electromagnetic experiments. Now, electromagnetic energy is stuff that's, you know, the universe is pinging with wavelengths of energy of all different, well, lengths. Like a wavelength is the difference, the distance between two crests of a electromagnetic wave. And what we see, of course, is just a tiny portion, visible light between, we can measure that, those wavelengths between 0.4 and 0.7 micrometers or microns. That's a millionth of a meter. Well, then there's many other kinds of electromagnetic energy, radio waves, microwaves, gamma rays, X-rays, etc., infrared radiation. And what we feel as heat, of course, is long-wave infrared radiation. Well, Tesla believed that the universe has so much energy that he designed and demonstrated that he wanted to build a huge transmitting tower at Warden Cliff on Manhattan Island. His funder was J.P. Morgan, and of course J.P. Morgan was an agent of the Rothschilds, like the Rockefellers, in America, one of the early robber barons who apparently did more economic activity during World War I than anybody else. But it was about that time that Tesla had a vision of free energy for everybody in the world. I mean, Tesla was an extremely brilliant and ascetic individual. Never got married because he felt like an inventor was like a priest. He was devoting his energy for the benefit of humans, all humans. So anyway, he wanted to build this tower. He designed it. He started it. It had an enormous transmitter and a Tesla coil at the top. And he thought that he was going to be able to wirelessly transmit energy for transportation, for ships, for cars, for planes, everything. Well, Tesla has been proven right on so many things. Of course, the rest of the story is that in 1943, he wanted to discuss free energy with President Roosevelt, and he had an appointment. The night before that, he died mysteriously. Hmm. Even though he was 80, a lot of people speculate that maybe it was, you know, murder, and that speculation is somewhat verified or at least substantiated by the fact that boxes and boxes of his papers disappeared at that time.
Yeah,
many of which went to the U.S. military. So the U.S. military, which I'm beginning to understand, is always 50 or 60 years ahead of the public, terms of what they can do, had access to Tesla's papers, and secretly so. They never owned up to that. But we now see Tesla technology being used at the HAARP facility in Alaska, which is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program that is an ionospheric heater and can beam electromagnetic energy anywhere on the planet, and there's something like 20 others around the world. So yes, I think free energy is available. And Dr. Judy Wood, who has done more research on 911, I think, than anyone else with the proper scientific background, her background is in materials engineering and visual optics, I think she looked at the photos, thousands of the photos, and she said, okay, a new kind of weapon was demonstrated on 911, and she thinks it was a free energy weapon.
That's right.
And, yeah.
So although there might be alternatives out there, we're not meant to have them at this point. We're meant to, well, how should we put it, Eric, go backwards? I mean, if we're cut off from the little technology that we do have access to at this moment, where will we end up at this stage?
Well, I think what we do see is two tiers of science, as I say. And where I taught with California State University, I think, you know, we get the science for the masses, which is kind of the dummy science, which is, you know, the ice is melting and the sea level's rising and the polar bears are dying and you better get emotionally involved and feel guilty and feel afraid. And then we have the real science, which is, you know, the free energy and the directed energy weapons and what they call non-lethal weapons now as a form of mind control that the military's been into for the last two or three decades. This is tightly held by the global elite. And the global elite, of course, seem to have plans to reduce the human population. So they don't seem to want to share these technologies with us. And yeah, you're right, we're not meant to have these. Now, if they'd wanted to in 1910, we could have gone, or 1920, we could have gone the direction of free energy. But again, J.P. Morgan pulled the funding to Tesla. His laboratory was burnt down, I think, in 1895. Mm-hmm. Morgan was powerful enough to keep Tesla from making good financial arrangements with other financiers. So there was, I think, even then an understanding that this was a very, very important and dangerous issue to their well-being. So they kept it under wraps, and they kept us from going that way. And of course, Rockefeller, by 1890, had a monopoly on 90% of the production and distribution of oil. So then the Rockefellers, who again are agents of the Rothschilds, were able to monopolize our energy source, and oil, coal, and gas, you know, then became the major bases of our economic system. Didn't have to be that way, apparently, but that's the way it's been. And so now, again, by trying to control the pricing and the distribution and the usage of fossil fuels, say by carbon taxes, it would appear that the ruling elite wants to slam on the brakes of the, you know, the prosperity,
yeah,
of the world.
It seems like we're not going backwards as well. I think you're right when you say that the options that are going to arise here is global, carbon taxes or something like that. It's being talked about right now, some kind of, some cases, a Tobin tax, it's called as, and many people seem to be okay with that as well, surprisingly, actually. That must show also how powerful the propaganda is, Eric.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Professor Robert M. Carter's book that I mentioned called Climate, the Counter Consensus, he actually tells, some of what's happening in Australia, including in one of the little textbooks for elementary school kids. The kids are given an exercise, I think it's in math, to calculate the amount of resources that they're using vis-a-vis the rest of the world, and then calculate the age that they should die so that other people will be able to get their fair share.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is extremely pernicious propaganda. Of course, kids are the most vulnerable to these lies. And, you can imagine how the effect of this kind of thing coming from the authorities on a kid's psyche.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read reports from some of the climatologists out there. They talk about that we have to have emotional appeal. You have to start using a language that only appeals to people's emotions, bypass the rationality. And in many regards, it seems to be also the reasons why they're doing it is because they know that they are right. So they have to take any means necessary to get their message across, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's a little more slippery and contrived than that.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you a quote here that I was at a panel discussion last spring at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and it was on man-made climate change in the sky, which of course gets into the geoengineering thing.
Yeah.
And I personally came to the conclusion that global warming is the cover story, not only for carbon taxing, but also for geoengineering. In other words, we've wrecked the climate, now we've got to try to fix it.
And of course, that's
nonsense. But in order to get people to go on board, like you say, they need to have this emotional investment in the issue, but no intellectual investment. So here's what Carter says. He quotes a group called the Institute for Public Policy Research, again in London, England. So much of this comes from England, by the way.
Yeah.
And he quotes this particular report, 2006. The task of climate change agencies is not to persuade by rational argument. Instead, we need to work in a more shrewd and contemporary way, using subtle techniques of engagement. The facts, quote unquote, need to be treated as being so taken for granted that they need not be spoken. Ultimately, positive climate behaviors need to be approached in the same way as marketeers approach acts of buying and consuming.
Yeah.
It amounts to treating climate-friendly activity as a brand that can be sold. This is, we believe, the route to mass behavior change.
Wow.
Well, this sounds exactly like Tavistock Institute of Human Relations kind of propaganda. And so the most recent paper that I've written is, in fact, mostly about the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, which is the premier brainwashing institution of the world coming out of London. And it's really coming out of the psychological warfare division of the British Army. And they started off looking at shell-shocked soldiers, hard to say that, shell-shocked soldiers, right after World War I, not to learn how to heal them, but to learn how the mind can be split, especially the public mind, so that people can be manipulated and controlled by fear and propaganda, etc., so that they could do the same thing to the public mind. So you get an idea of then warfare against the public. And this, unfortunately, and of course Tavistock has so many spin-off organizations like the Club of Rome and the Stanford Research Institute and big part of MIT and the Wharford Financial Institute, and I mean you can just go on. It's a lot of these are listed in my upcoming paper, but the public the Institute of Public Policy Research, which they mention here or Carter mentions, this is another Stanford or Tavistock kind of PR firm. This goes back to Edward Bernays' 1928 book called Propaganda. And Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And of course, Sigmund Freud, the father of modern psychology or psychoanalysis. So these tools then were used mostly and have been used largely against the public, not for the public.
Let's talk a little bit more about the propaganda. One thing that we always hear many times anyway is that there is a consensus out there among scientists about anthropogenic global warming, but the fact is that there are plenty of dissidents out there like yourselves, but are they just kept out of the press and the media, or is there another way that they're doing it? How do they create this atmosphere that we currently have today?
Yeah, very, very, very good question, very shrewd, and I've got a book here, which I'm like, my next segment is going to be on mind control, and what we're looking at here is very, 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 very sophisticated mind control from some of our top Tavistock-like agencies, but also our intelligence agencies. And the book I've got here is called Project Soul Catcher, Volume 2, Secrets of Cyber and Cybernetic Warfare Revealed by Robert Duncan and the Mind Hacking Strategy Group. on page 66, he talks about how the CIA has been involved ever since pretty much it was formed by the National Security Act in 1947 in a thing called influence mapping. Influence mapping, and they had their tentacles in all of educational institutions and of course, the military-industrial complex, corporations, etc., to make sure the right kind of people were in the right kind of positions to advance the right policies and the right perceptions. So we see, if we start to look at, you know, Operation MK Ultra, mind control in the 50s and 60s, and that's been ongoing. These are CIA-sponsored projects. We see that the CIA has partnered up with the Tavistock Institute and the British Intelligence and, you know, many, many other intelligence agencies. And their particular role has been to make sure that certain voices are heard and certain voices are suppressed. Now, interestingly enough, I can look back on my career now. You know, they say life can only be lived forward and understood backwards.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a, well, I don't want to get into it too much, but I had some huge roadblocks put in front of me along the way, which I think would have taken out many other people who were a little less dedicated or determined. In other words, tenure was denied to me in a couple of different places.
Yeah.
I had to fight my way through that, and it was very, very exhausting. And now I know that this whole issue has been around long enough, and the surveillance of our intellectuals has been severe enough so that I might have been targeted by forces way beyond those that I perceived at the time. In other words, there may have been some very coordinated attempts to derail my career. So anyway, yeah, the answer is I can see now in my lifetime that certain professors with certain ideologies are rewarded with grant money and positions, and others are selectively punished and sometimes hounded out. And it's gotten very, very obvious. For instance, there was a report that came by saying in the last year or two that 700 university presidents in the United States have signed on to a document committing themselves to the climate change issue. Okay, so you can imagine that out of those 700 university presidents, nobody probably has any background whatsoever in climatology. You know, these would be coming from, you know, English or business or, you know, I mean, just all of the different disciplines. And climatology is a very small one, actually. So yeah. Maybe there was one. Let's say there was one out of 700.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of these guys then are committed to maintaining the kind of the right mix of professors to profess the right things. Now, this became evident at my school, my university, Cal State University Stanislaus, last spring when we were hiring a new faculty in physical geography. And the dean, who of course is responding to the pressure from the president, actually looked at all of the applications and told us which one he wanted, which is unheard of in academic policy. And it turns out the one he wanted was from Britain and was a computer climate guy. Well, we didn't hire that guy, but for the dean to come in and say we want this one, we had to fight him to get the guy we wanted.
Huh. How about that?
So that kind of direct meddling, I think, has been going on. Now, if you want to find out the what I would say the counter consensus, it's not a good word because science is not done in consensus. But there's a Senator James Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, who is president of the Science and Public Works Committee, who has, and you can Google him, and the Committee of on Science and Public Works, and one of his kind of energetic aides has put together statements from top scientists around the world that are very, very brilliant debunking of the man-caused global warming scam, myth, whatever you want to call it, hypothesis, theory. I think it's been disproven. In fact, I wrote a paper on my website, www.naturalclimatechange.us, called Disproofs of the Hypothesis of Man-Caused Global Warming and Proofs that AGW, Anthropogenic Global Warming, is a fraud. Yep. You know, or and so I drew heavily on the statements that were online coming out of James Inhofe's Senate committee. Really brilliant statements. I mean, we're coming to a better understanding of climate all the time. I initially thought all of this public attention on global warming was going to be good because it meant more research dollars and more public attention. But then, of course, over time, I began to realize that this is simply propaganda. You know.
Yeah. What drives the climate, would you say, ultimately? Is it the sun? Is it the stars themselves? There's an interesting theory by Sven Smark, you know, the Danish,
right,
about the stars being responsible. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it, I remember hearing Stephen Jay Gould, who was the chairman of the geology and biology departments at Harvard, give a talk in 1985 at the University of Boulder, Colorado, in which he said, the most complicated problem facing science is to unravel the causes and the patterns of climate change. And I think, you know, that's a fair statement. I think that what we know now, or at least the genuine scientists know now, is light years ahead of what we knew 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But the public consensus, I'd say right now, is probably light years behind what the science of climatology knew in 1950. In other words, we've selectively forgotten most of what we've known, at least that's the junk science part. But going back to your question, which is, you know, the $64 question, I can't answer with a surety, but I can say that there's a lot of good evidence that, okay, the sun, when I took my first climatology classes in the mid-70s, we were taught that the sun gave off a fixed amount of radiation every year called the solar constant.
Wow.
Well, now we know from satellite measurements that the solar constant isn't constant,
yep. Yep.
And that the sun is a variable star. We also know that the sun has a very complex magnetic field, and that the solar magnetism changes much, much more than the flux of solar radiation itself. And it is this flux of magnetic energy. See, you could look at the Earth as part of the as being inside the sun's atmosphere. And so when the magnetic activity of the sun, the solar plasma, if you will, is more intense, then this would seem to block incoming cosmic radiation, which is formed when you have nova, supernova in space, and it's always pinging around the atmosphere and the universe. And people like Sven Smark, like you say, have a theory that that the variations in the sun's magnetic field have a direct influence on not only temperature but moisture, because as cosmic rays come in from outer space, they're very tiny, but they also can form condensation nuclei, or tiny particles around which water vapor condenses into water droplets, and of course that is what causes clouds and precipitation. So when we have less solar magnetic activity, this is when we would expect more cosmic radiation, and this is when we might have a little bit wetter and cooler conditions. And we're learning now that, we have solar cycles of 11, 22, 90, 270, and various other periodicities. The other main thing I think we see is that, 70% of the Earth is covered with ocean water, and the oceans are quite deep, and they hold much, 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 much more heat than the atmosphere, which is just simply comprised of gases.
Yeah.
And that the ocean currents themselves are driven by these differences in energy and temperature between the equator and the poles, and that the ocean then becomes the other major driver of local and global climate. So you have a whole number of factors: the oceans, the sun, variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun. Those are the main ones right now that I would look at to explain cycles. And yeah, we know climate changes in cycles. And I'll give you a little quick story. I was just up in Glacier Park where I did my PhD research, and couldn't walk my dog, you know, so I'd leave him in the car, and my dog pooped in the car. And so I came back.
Sorry about that.
This is a puppy, 6 months. And so I put the dog outside, cleaned up the car, and this pretty young blonde park ranger came over and started chatting with me just to make sure, you know, everything was okay. And so we had an interesting talk, and then she told me that the glaciers are almost gone and they're not coming back. And, you know, obviously she was in law enforcement and she has no basis for stating, especially the second comment.
Yeah.
So then I went over to the park visitor center and looked at all the displays, and there was one that said, computer simulations indicate that by 2020, all the glaciers in Glacier Park will be gone. So then I went up to the ranger there and said, you know, politely, well, okay, 2020 is 8 years away, so what are you going to do in 8 years if and when the glaciers are still there? And he said, well, I guess we'll change the sign. So then we started talking back and forth, you know. But what came out in the discussion was that his boss is telling all the employees in the Park Service to be pushing the idea that the glaciers are leaving for good.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is propaganda now coming from our national parks. Crazy,
so,
you know.
And by the way, while we're on that subject, what really is going on there? Because I've read plenty of articles now about the growing glaciers around the world. Himalayan glaciers are apparently growing. And this is, of course, in the field of so-called, you know, regular journalism and science, this is a complete shock, and they have yet to understand what is going on with this. But it's taking place in quite a few places right now, isn't it?
Oh yeah, there's a website dedicated to this. I think it's called Real Ice Age News or something like that, and they'll go around and tell you which glaciers in the world are growing. And it turns out, you know, most of them are.
Yeah.
And in fact, the climate has been cooling since 1998. That's what is shown by even the official climate recording places, and 90% of the Earth's ice is in Antarctica, and Antarctica has been getting slightly cooler since, well, over the last 40-50 years, and it's growing vertically, it's expanding. We are seeing some melt back in the northern, you know, the Arctic, but there's a lot of speculation from people who've been looking at geoengineering that this is due to intentional geoengineering of the military in order to expose more areas for oil and gas exploration, among other reasons.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, you're right. The storyline that the glaciers are melting doesn't even hold up.
Yeah.
They're advancing.
I have a comment for you, and then one last question is before we take a little break here in a while. I want to talk a little bit more about your website as well. But it's almost at this point then that it's like a religion right now. And if you're a disbeliever, you're kind of ousted. It's faith-based instead of scientifically based, right? Very strange.
Yeah, and this is the genius of propaganda to show that the importance of religion and religious thinking. And so the propagandists understand this. And of course, in the last few years taught climatology, talking about these issues, I had some pretty stiff resistance from some of my students who were true believers.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
So
interesting.
Yeah.
Does mankind have any effect or impact on the environment at all, in your view? Should there be any limits to anything, or should we have, free rein to all the resources that are available on the planet? So what's your view on this, Eric?
Well, I think the reason why that they're able to, you know, sell this storyline about global warming, of course, is that, sure, locally we have pollution. And if you live in a big city like Los Angeles or, you know, probably even Stockholm, you know, you can see that there are a number of, industrial pollutants, nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, ozone, ground-level ozone. All of these have harmful effects locally. And, of course, CO2 is the basis of photosynthesis. So it is a miracle gas. There's nothing negative about CO2. And CO2 has been, 10 or 20 times higher in the past, geologic past, without any, damage. In fact, if you add more CO2, plants grow better. And of course, with more plants, then, you can have better agriculture. But yeah, locally, we have pollution. And I think what happens is that people in urban areas see the local pollution, they don't know better, and they think that CO2 must be, one of the problems, and so they're willing to sign on to this religion because they want a cleaner air and cleaner water. So it builds on these fairly obvious and logical observations, which is that, yeah, we're producing pollution. So yes, it'd be nice if we get off fossil fuels, because fossil fuels have a lot of negatives. But CO2, carbon dioxide is not one of them in my mind.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask you later, next segment here, about what would happen if we had more carbon, dioxide and monoxide in our inner atmosphere, what the effects of this would be, basically. But we're going to talk more about this, and I also want to ask you more about the propagandists and the manipulators and who actually is pulling the strings here behind the scenes in our next hour. Before we take a break, though, I want to talk about the website a little bit more, naturalclimatechange.us, naturalclimatechange.us. Just tell our listeners here who haven't been on your website before what they can find there, and if there's anything specifically you recommend on the website, Eric.
Yeah, there's a lot of information on this. I put it together over the last 4 years. and, of course, this is the based on the research that I've done all my professional career. A couple of my professional articles are posted there. An awful lot of PowerPoints are put on there, as well as articles that I've written. One article I think is very important. It's called Global Green Dictatorship, which I wrote in 2008 when I started to realize that the United Nations Agenda 21 and regional governance and smart growth and sustainable development are all part of a globalist plan, again, to take away sovereignty from the individual nation states and to put us under kind of a global government, the prototype, the first one of which would be the United Nations. And so, there's lots of articles like that. There's the disproofs of man-caused global warming, which is 80 pages. I wrote that about a year and a half ago. There's the PowerPoint that I did on the man-caused climate change in the sky, which is basically an introduction to geoengineering, chemtrails, if you want to call it that, or persistent contrails. It turns out that this has a history that goes back, about 70 years. We're talking about weather warfare, environmental warfare. Again, the military's all over this stuff, but it's mostly secret. But I basically traced the documents, military documents, patents, and historical events over the last 70 years that show that geoengineering is real. It's the face of warfare in the future because, hey, if you start an earthquake somewhere else or guide a hurricane to slam into some coastline, you can say nature did it. But HARP, this facility I told you about in Alaska, and other ionospheric heaters, along with the Gwen Towers and various technologies we probably don't even know about, they can now meddle in these very extreme environmental effects. There are lots of documents about weather warfare that go back 1966. McDonald was part of a think tank, I think with Rand, that got a lot of attention in Washington, D.C. I wrote an article, How to Wreck the Environment. Well, again, this is the real science. This is the stuff that's carefully held and not taught, unfortunately, at universities. So I was up against the problem of now I'm tapping into the real science and the university doesn't want to hear about it. And even most of the students don't want to hear about it because they're so, like you say, propagandized to have this religious viewpoint that humans are destroying the environment. Well, it's not you and me driving our cars. It might be the military with their geoengineering and weather warfare. Yeah, they can do a lot of damage.
That's so, right. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind is made up as it goes,
Right.
All right, really good. The naturalclimatechange.us, that's the website. Head on over there. Check it out. There's a lot of material there for you. We're going to tune into a little music here at this point, and then we'll take a short break between the segments here. Stay with us, Eric. We'll be right back with more.
Thank you.
are going to continue shortly with Dr. Erik Karlström in our members area. I just want to let you know that in our open archive, we have over a year of radio programs available for you for free. You can download or stream at your convenience. We also offer an RSS feed, an iPhone app, and a whole mobile website as well. We have developed a number of ways so that you easily can access and listen to the program. As a plus, we do not have any commercial interruptions, and we have an ad-free website. So the way this works is that when you want to hear more, all of our programs going back to 2006 in their entirety, with the first and the second hour, you can subscribe and acquire a membership. This is how we continue to produce material, and it also allows us to expand and develop into new areas and produce more material. So thank you for considering subscribing. It's only 5 euros per month. Try it out for a 3-month subscription. You'll get, of course, full access, and you can download everything that's on there if you so please. You can find more information and all the details on redicecreations.com. Next on Red Ice Radio, Alex Newman returns for a special appearance live from the United Nations Earth Summit down in Rio. After this, Peter Halldorsson, Nils Axel Mörner, Helen Caldicott, Freeman, Janice Barcelo, Grunvalo Melchizedek, and many more. For a full list of upcoming guests, simply click in to our radio archive. More coming up right now with Erik Karlström, Hour 2 for members.